Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. You're listening to America This Week.
We are back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. This is Tim Reedy with Carrie Weber, and we are talking with our legal affairs editor, Ellen Bogle, about some of the cases that the Supreme Court is talking about. And we were just talking about cases involving juror discrimination and race. And of course, race plays a big part in a lot of cases that the Supreme Court takes up. So we want to segue a little bit to talking about death penalty cases and where some of those stand and some of the strategies behind that. We also want to invite you to join the conversation. If you have any questions for Ellen, Professor Bogle, about the Supreme Court cases or some of these issues, you could feel free to call us at 1-888-3-CATHOLIC. That's 1-888-322-8465. Professor Bogle, there was a lot of attention a few weeks ago regarding the case, I believe Richard Glossop in Oklahoma, regarding his status. He was the governor stepped in and stayed his execution, but that is still something that is getting a lot of attention because of the law regarding, I believe, the medicines that are used in Oklahoma for lethal execution, something that the court has taken up in the past. What are some of the other issues related to the death penalty that the court is considering these days?
Right. Well, this has been an incredibly active month for the Supreme Court with regard to death penalty. They've had about three death penalty cases. And some of them are technical in terms of the sentencing instructions that are given to the jury. So the jury has to decide whether to, well, each, first of all, you know, most of these death penalty cases, almost all of them are state law cases. So the statutes from each state are what can lead to a death penalty. When the court reviews them, they have to look for them very specifically at what the language of the statute is and how that's implemented. One of the factors that the court's looking at today, or you know, in this session, is the role of the jury in making that determination. In previous cases, it's held that the jury must decide whether to implement the death penalty or to charge for the death penalty, give a sentence of the death penalty, and that they must also consider aggravating circumstances or mitigating factors in determining whether to use that punishment. The question in a case that's coming out of Florida has a unique system in which both the judge and the jury are involved in issuing the death sentence, and the judge actually has the final say. And so the court really is taking a look at the oral argument was just the other day into making sure that the juries understand their responsibility. And this also comes up in a case that's out of Kansas. So very clearly that the jury be informed or that the jury actually be the ones making that decision. So again, going back to the constitutional right to be tried by a jury of one's peers, and that also the sentence, in this case, you know, for capital punishment, be done by the jury and not by a judge. And so it's been, you know, phrased in terms of even like the moral responsibility of the jury for making this decision. So it's going to be very interesting to see how the courts come out on those rulings.
Right. And now death penalty opponents are divided a little bit about whether or not they want, how the strategy around whether or not to push some of these cases into court or hope they rule now versus later, a kind of all-at-once strategy or a more gradual strategy? Have you thought about this at all?
Sure.
Can you explain that to us?
This is always, you know, a risk, I guess, if you will, about pushing forward some kind of social change. You know, even looking back to last year and previous years with the same-sex marriage cases, there were those who might have advocated for a legislative solution. And that same is true with death penalty, where there are advocates obviously working very hard in the states that have death penalties to try to have their legislatures change those laws. And then there are those who want to go for the jugular, get the Supreme Court to issue a ruling which would be nationwide and which would be effective and immediate and direct. And so I don't know that there's there's certainly two different theories of the best way to progress if you're an opponent of the death penalty. I don't know that there's really a right or wrong in the sense that we have the death penalty now. So I think if you're an opponent, anything that you can do to minimize it is a good thing. But it is you know, Justice Scalia has sort of criticized this way of hacking away, or he's called it guerrilla warfare on the death penalty, which may be an effective strategy. It will be interesting to see if any of these cases get to that direct question of whether the death penalty is, as we know it, unconstitutional. None of them are phrased in that manner, that it's an open question or an obvious question, that the five justices would just say out and out, the death penalty is not constitutional here. They had that opportunity last year when they ruled, or in June when they ruled on the drug, as you mentioned, in the Glossop case, Ms. Adelam, and they said that it was permissible to use that drug even though it caused pain. They had the opportunity then. They didn't take it. I don't know that they're ready to take it now, but we'll see. But each of the questions that are before the court today are those like chipping away questions, and they're not a direct frontal assault. So we'll see what happens.
Now, I know we talked a lot about this issue when Pope Francis was here, because he made this a center point of his argument to Congress that the complete abolition of the death penalty. So that message came through loud and clear. But something else that he's talked about is the kind of life imprisonment that faces people, and kind of the in some ways the life sentence that is for, and especially for young people. And this is a case, another area that you've written about for us regarding mandatory life sentencing for juveniles. Maybe you can bring us up to speed on that. This is something that the Supreme Court struck down, but there's some question as to whether that's retroactive and applies to past cases.
Right. And this, you know, it's an issue which seems to boggle the mind, that once the Supreme Court declares something unconstitutional, such as, you say, a mandatory life sentence for a juvenile, for somebody who committed a crime as a juvenile, you would think, and, you know, when I teach this in class, my students are sort of dumbfounded. They just kind of assume that, well, then everyone who's in jail, who's been sentenced to a mandatory life sentence as a juvenile, now gets a resentencing, and that's just not the case. And it has to be determined first whether this pronouncement by the Supreme Court is something that should be retroactively applied. And then in the question that's before the court this year, again, there's a very technical procedural question, comes out of the state of Louisiana, and the question really is whether the Supreme Court even has jurisdiction to hear an appeal from a state court in this kind of a situation where it's not necessarily a constitutional issue about whether that constitutional determination is retroactive. Very strange procedurally. All it means really is that it will be delayed. It's possible that the ruling on whether the ruling is retroactive will be delayed. I think it's very clear that the Supreme Court agrees this should be applied retroactively, that the sentences of juveniles who were sentenced to mandatory life sentences should be reviewed, all of them individually. But how long it will take for that to get through the system is, it could be a very long process. And as you say, you know, some of these people have been in jail 40, 50 years. And so that's a very difficult thing. And I think, as the Pope pointed out, it's something which more could be done, and yet our process is very slow and painstaking.
Right. Now, Professor Ellen Bogle, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about a story that's been in the news the past couple of days coming out of Nevada. There's a school choice program there that's being threatened by what's called the Little Blaine Amendment. And it's students in Nevada public schools are being given vouchers. Their families are being given vouchers to spend on private education elsewhere in the state because Nevada's schools have been shown to be underperforming. And so, but this... these vouchers are being challenged by the ACLU because some of them can be used toward education that might be based in a particular faith, like a Catholic school or whatnot. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the implications of such a fight.
Sure. So, the as you mentioned, the Blaine Amendment, which is named after a Speaker of the House back from the 1800s, who wanted to have a federal constitutional amendment that would prohibit public funding for religious institutions, and that never went through, but many states have adopted either constitutional amendments or maybe statutes that do the same. And so this is a question that has come up in other states before. Indiana had a similar law, and in 2013, their highest state court ruled that the voucher system or that they had did not violate their amendment, their Blaine Amendment. Colorado, though, recently ruled that it's a different, you know, somewhat different but similar school funding or tax credit voucher system did violate the Colorado Constitution. So these are all state constitutional questions, not U.S. constitutional questions at this point, but state constitutional questions. And so the answer is different throughout the states because the wording is slightly different and, frankly, because their courts interpret them differently. Now, what's interesting, and it may come up out of the Colorado case more quickly, is that now religious schools are challenging the Colorado ruling, saying that the U.S. Constitution, the First Amendment, the U.S. Constitution is being violated because they are not eligible to receive the money under the Colorado scheme. So we may see a little bit of a standoff here between, you know, what takes precedence, the U.S. Constitution or the state constitutions, and the U.S. Constitution clearly takes precedence. And the next question is whether they are really in that direct conflict or not regarding the use of state funds for these voucher systems or tax credits.
Now, this is our colleague Kevin Clark has a story up about this at our website. And one of the interesting things here about the Nevada case is they had thought they'd come up with a system that could get around some of the traditional constitutional objections to voucher programs. You know, the idea that money, public money, could be used for sectarian Catholic schools. This, of course, carries an issue that America has been writing about for decades because it's always been felt that this was anti-religious, anti-Catholic to not allow parents this choice. But here, these are kind of, it's unique. They've got account funds that are set up for parents that can be used for a variety of educational purposes, including private schooling, but also tutoring, online learning, et cetera. And the hope was by setting up this slightly different way of going about it, that maybe they could set up a model that could be adapted by other states. But the ACLU has jumped in here, citing this Little Blaine Amendment, although not in name, hoping to kind of cut this off before it's perhaps taken up by other states. So I guess we're going to have to wait and see here, Ellen, whether or not their effort is successful, because it seems like there's a lot of state legislators that would be open and eager to try something like this.
Right. Well, I think, you know, the public education is you know, in some ways you could say public education is under attack as well. I think, you know, there's obviously the other side is that, you know, private school education has been under attack for a long time. So there's both sides of the coin there. Interesting, another little wrinkle in this is that there was a similar Florida law, and more with vouchers than with tax credits. As you point out, the Nevada one is somewhat unique. But Florida had a constitutional amendment that required the state to provide education through a free public school system. And so the Florida Supreme Court held that this voucher system that the state legislature there had put forward violated the constitutional amendment that they had to provide free public schools. So it's just very interesting how all these different, you know, issues kind of come to a head in this one very important, you know, idea of how do we educate our young people. And you're right, the Nevada one with the use of the tax credits and is an interesting way to try to prevent any you know, possible violation of the Constitution with regard to overreaching into church and state affairs. But and tax credits are given for a lot of reasons. You know, it's interesting. I mean, we give tax credits for people to buy, you know, cars that don't use as much fuel or to buy solar panels. So we use tax credits for a lot of things. And so it is kind of interesting to see that it's being attacked here when it's being used for, you know, just people trying to provide education for their children. On the other hand, I think, you know, there's that other issue of whether it's sort of an attack on the entire public school system and a privatization of something that we once thought was a fundamental purpose of government, and that's being eroded, I think, a little bit here.
Right. Now, Ellen, we have just about a minute left. I wonder if you could name one or two other cases that you think Catholics should be aware of in the coming months.
Well, I think a big one that, you know, may be heard by the Supreme Court, we're not sure yet, is the ongoing question about the Affordable Care Act mandate and the requirement for religious organizations that want to be exempt from the contraceptive requirements under the healthcare law, and what specific type of notice that they must give to the government to say that they want to be exempt from this or accommodated in that way. And so I think that's an interesting case that is now we have what they call a split in the circuits. Most of the courts have ruled against the religious organizations and said that although it's the law provides that they do not have to provide that coverage, the law also provides that they have to give a certain type of notice. And but we just recently, the Eighth Circuit came out and said that ruled in favor of the religious groups. So now we have different the law being applied differently in different parts of the country, which is never a good thing. So it is quite possible that the Supreme Court may take up that case.
Very good. Thank you so much, Professor Bogle, for your insights this week. We really appreciate them as always. And you can find more of Professor Bogle's writings at americamagazine.org.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.